tumbling down, pledging their love.
Welcome
to
back
the
to
ground.
Cinema Demore. I'm one of your hosts, Justin Morgan. I'm here with John Phillips. We're going to talk about the Coen brothers, The Big Lebowski. My question to you, Chuck, is this or is this not the greatest film noir of our age?
Cares of the past are behind.
Yeah.
It is a great film. Where to go, but I'll find. It's like one of the most, I don't want to say it's subtle, but it kind of is the way it kind of like sneaks into film noir territory. Like it works all the tropes in. From, you know, a character just kind of like stumbling into the plot. The plot's ridiculously convoluted. So many fake outs and MacGuffins going on in this film. There's a femme fatale. There's, you know, all those classic plot elements just wrapped up into a story about a guy that just wants to go bowling and just wants compensation for his rug. That's all he wants. The most basic. He does not want to get involved in anything. He just wants his rug replaced, and he just wants to bowl with his friends.
It's true. I wanted to loosen you up. How much do you love this movie?
I mean, I'd say it is probably my favorite Coen Brothers movie. It's definitely... It's probably the one I would say I've rewatched the most. I mean, I've seen this movie... Yeah, probably more than any of their other films by a long shot.
All right. Well, I'm going to throw some trivia at you then.
You can throw it away.
Thought that was a good way to start things. Some aren't that hard, but I'm going to try with the ones that aren't too crazy.
Yeah.
The dude tells Walter about the rug incident. Dude says this aggression will not stand and that he needs to draw a line in the sand. The movie shows footage of another man using these words.
George H.W. Bush.
Yes, very good.
Yeah. Oh, the connections are. I mean, this movie is all about Desert Storm from all the little things, like him repeating that exact same line that he sees in the supermarket to the Saddam Hussein as the shoe guy in his dream.
In the beginning of the movie, how much does the dude write a check for at the grocery store?
69 cents.
Correct. 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 Bunny's real name.
Oh. I remember her last name is, her parents are the Knutsons, and I can't remember what her actual name is. I know her name in Logjammin is like, Bunny LaJoya, but and then I can't remember what her actual first name is. I just know the Knutsons because he keeps repeating the private eye says it.
Three.
The private eye says it, and Jeff Bridges, who the fuck are the Knutsons?
It's Fawn. Fawn's the name.
Fawn, that's it, yeah. It's another animal, like, yeah.
When the dude is dreaming, what is the name of the movie starring Maudin himself?
No, Gutterballs.
Yeah. What day of the week will Walter not bowl?
Shomer Shabbos, which is Saturday.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is I've seen this movie so many times. There's all the little tiny things in it. I love the I don't know. We'll get to all those things in due course, but just even from the way this movie starts out, I love Jackie Treehorn's two thugs, one of which played by Jacob of Lost.
Yeah.
And just when they're like destroying everything in his house, he's just like, they just like stop. Hey, didn't that guy say this Lebowski guy was a millionaire or something like that? And they're like, yeah, this place does look like a dump.
What does he call the bowling ball? When he says, what is this? And he drops it. You guys obviously don't know.
Oh, yeah. What does he say? I'm trying to think. I can't think of what he says on that
it's
one.
It's another sport. Golf.
Oh, yeah, golf.
You guys obviously don't know golf.
Drops it and smashes all the tiles on his floor. Where's the money, Lebowski? I don't know. I'm pretty sure it was down there. Why don't you give me another look?
What president does he have on the poster of his wall?
Nixon.
Very good.
Yeah, Nixon bowling. But I mean, the real Lebowski, the real big Lebowski, got his picture with Nancy Reagan. He also met Ronnie, but, you know, didn't get the picture because they were in a rush.
Who does Walter accuse of going over the line?
Smokey.
Yep.
I lost that shirt. I think I might have finally got a hole in it. I had that shirt for the longest time.
It was Market Zero.
And I think it, like, it just fell apart from me wearing it too much and washing it too many times that it just, like, started to fall apart, and I had to, like, get rid of it at some point because I keep trying to find it and I can never locate it anymore. So I think that's what happened with it.
What type of shoe does the dude often wear?
Oh, he's got those jellies.
Yep.
Those clear jellies. It looks like he's never wearing shoes half the time because they're so clear.
You're doing really good. Is this freshening you up? It's making your brain go a little bit.
It is making me think.
I'm just trying to think of another one. According to the dude, how does Jackie Treehorn treat objects?
He treats objects like people.
No.
What is he? Oh, how does he phrase it?
Like women.
Oh yeah, treats objects like women. Yeah, I knew it was a play on. He treats it. He puts it backwards. The way he says it. Yeah.
We won't do all trivia, but I think I'm going to keep throwing trivia
just,
at
just,
you.
Just randomly toss them out there. Yeah, this is another. This is their movie right after Fargo, which. I do love that they did two movies in a row that are have very convoluted, like, fake kidnapping plots in them that go in completely different directions, whereas Fargo plays much more of that just flat out, like, black comedy, especially with Peter Stormare and Steve Buscemi in that film as the two bumbling hitmen. So, you know, it's good that this is finally, these two movies, finally, you know, Steve Buscemi's getting a real meaty part to work with. He was always just, like, kind of in a scene or two in these previous films of the Coens. And I love the descriptions.
Donnie, will you shut the fuck up?
I love the descriptions that everyone keeps giving in Fargo about his character. They just go, I don't know, he's funny looking. And everyone goes, be more specific. He's like, just his face was just funny. Like, they can't describe what it is about him, but they just go, I don't know, just his face just in general was funny looking. He just constantly gets mocked.
Yeah, he's the same in this. He's just there to get fucking ridiculed
to get mocked the entire time, especially by Walter.
I think it's almost exclusively
pretty much
Walter.
Is, yeah. Yeah, that's the character that he has the most interaction with. Like, the dude almost never, I'm actually genuinely trying to think if the dude ever actually says a line to Donnie. It almost, you could almost, like, play this movie as if imagining Donnie was dead from the beginning or something like that, and he's just haunting Walter, because no other character does interact with Donnie in the slightest. It is only Walter all the time, and most of the time it is him screaming at Donnie.
He does get the ashes on him, so
yeah,
he has to exist.
He is a real character, but yeah, there is just something about this movie, and it continues with, like, a lot of those Coen brothers themes. Obviously, the dreams that they put in a lot of their films, characters having dreams, kind of either foreshadowing things or revealing, you know, parts of their character, parts of their psyche. We get a few extended dream montages from the dude as he keeps getting repeatedly knocked out throughout this film, which made me think of Miller's Crossing now that I've seen that, and that's like the other movie that I'm thinking of where the main character is just constantly getting punched in the face and knocked down on the floor constantly throughout the entire movie. But this is just played more for laughs than being serious like that film.
I always the lines stick in your head too. They're almost, I don't know if it's just comedies, because I probably have also watched this more than any other Coen Brothers movie, because it tends to be the one that's, like, always on TV, and yeah, you always just start watching it. But yeah, it's like I feel like anytime somebody bumps into you while you're drinking, you're like, dude, watch it, I got a beverage here. Like, everything falls back to this movie. And was it critically panned? I know it didn't make any money in theaters.
I don't think it was. I think it got, like, Like, I don't think it was like pan, but I do think it wasn't. It like got like right in the middle, kind of like mix. Like, it wasn't like their best reaction. I think especially coming off of Fargo, which won them Academy Awards for screenplay, and Frances McDormand won an Academy Award. And it was also McDormand.
They
was
won
also
best
nominated.
Frances McDormand.
Yeah, it was also nominated for, you know, Best Picture and Best Director. So I think a lot of people looked at that and were like, oh, Fargo, that's like an amazing film. It's such a deep story. And then like they kind of did the same thing after Blood Simple, where they were just like, let's do the goofiest thing you could ever imagine us doing, like a movie about like losers that live in California and love to play bowling all the time. Like, that's all they love.
Yeah, bowling seems to come up a lot in their movies as well. I don't know why.
I think it's just that. It feels like the most American of sports.
Yeah.
Like, it's the one sport that you can really pinpoint that I don't know of anybody else that, I mean, they might bowl in other countries. It might be somewhat common.
Well, they have to, but maybe it started here.
But I feel like it's like, that's your thought of like 50s Americanas. Like, you know, I think of like Pleasantville, like all the guys go to the bowling lanes and like leave their wives at home. And they have like a whole scene where he's like, she left the food in the oven and told me to heat it up. Like, the guy's got like the big iron mark on the back of his shirt. Like, she didn't finish ironing my bowling shirt. Like that's just like a classic American thing.
We'll have to cover that when we do black and white films.
Yeah, that's another great one.
That slowly turned into color.
Yeah, there's a few we can do there, but yeah, this is another one of those. They do really love to get into, and another thing they do love is getting into those very specific like regional dialects and like a very specific way of having people talk. They do that in like Raising Arizona. All the characters kind of talk in like this really strange accent.
They may do
there.
It in Fargo.
Yeah. Yeah. They go real heavy into it in Fargo. They do love the, and I don't, that just makes everything stand out more, just the way they really make all the characters feel like they're definitely in the same universe. They all talk in the same, like, you know, heavily accented. They all have the same, like, slang that they use to refer to everything. Yeah, this, I think the best part about this movie, again, kind of like I said, the way they really subtly put the film noir elements into this goofy movie. You know, we start out with, right off the bat, Jeff Lebowski, the dude, his dudeness, El Duderino, if you're not into the brevity thing, getting assaulted by two thugs that he has no clue who they are, because it's a whole case of mistaken identity. And that just kicking off, you know, Walter telling him, no, man, you got to find this other Lebowski. You got to get involved in it. Where it's like, if he'd have just accepted that his rug got peed on and left it alone, he never would have got sucked into anything. But Walter's like,
I mean, he even brings that up in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, Walter's like, no, man, the dude, that rug really tied the room together. You can't just let this go unchecked like that. Also, Chinaman's not the preferred nomenclature. It's Asian American.
And isn't he the one that brings that up too? Isn't it Walter that says it at first?
No, the dude keeps saying it at first, but then after he says like Chinaman is not the preferred nomenclature, then he goes, look, dude, the Chinaman peed on your rug. Like, he keeps using it even after he says you shouldn't use it.
I did watch the Jesus Rolls movie. Did you watch that?
No, I didn't get a chance to get that one in.
It's not very good.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have high hopes for it, being that it's not, it's only like barely connected. It's not the,
it's weird because Jesus Quintana is a small character that just pops up for like basically a laugh in the bowling
but he's
league.
So memorable because of how ridiculous John Turturro's performance is that you can't, like, I understand why he would want to do that character again, because he's so fun for like the all of 5 minutes that he's on the screen,
and it kind of doesn't really work for longer than 5 minutes. But they do, the movie doesn't really have a plot. It really doesn't even have a purpose. It kind of just goes from thing to thing to thing.
I'll ask, not like,
yeah, go ahead.
Don't get into spoilers, but is anybody else in the movie from this other than him?
No.
Okay. I mean, I kind of figured. I know, obviously, you know, some of the other actors have passed away that worked on this film, and the Coens weren't. Did they at least produce it or anything?
I didn't even see a producing credit. I think John Turturro was trying to get this movie made for a long time. Well, maybe not a long time, but been trying to convince the Coens to do it. And they were like, why don't you direct it? And that's what it seems like, a person that's not a great director. But they do, it does explain one thing that is brought up in the movie. Why would you want to make a movie about a pedophile? And so they do have a flashback sequence to explain how he got arrested for showing himself to an 8-year-old, which is literally just him in the bathroom pissing, and an 8-year-old's like, wow, you got big balls, sir. And he's like, oh, one day you will too. And like the dad walks out of the stall as he's talking to the kid.
That's such a weird, yeah, that's a weird way to go with that.
Yeah, there's a couple people in it. John Hamm, Pete Davidson, Susan Sarandon. And I swear to God, everybody has a couple minutes and then you never see them again.
It was probably just one of those, like they could only get them for a day or something like that to come in.
Yeah, there's just some weird stuff in it that's not even funny. And I think it's just because it's like, I don't really understand. In the movie's short. It's like 1:20, and it still feels like, what the fuck was the point of that movie? Anyways, I can't recommend it, but that's actually kind of rare. I'm usually like, go see it.
Yeah.
Check it out once, I guess.
I'll watch it eventually. I mean, I own it, so I'll get to it at some point, but...
But yeah, you had his strange character that always stands out. Because he's probably the craziest buller that there is, besides themselves, Walter, that's pulling a handgun.
Everyone else just seems like, just really normal average people. Then, you've got the dude Donnie and Walter that are all weird in their own different ways.
Well, I mean, you can follow them pretty easily. If you have good characters, interesting characters, you can follow something that really doesn't have much of a plot. But I think something like this is really interesting, how the whole idea is mistaken identity and they ruined his rug.
Yeah.
They ruined more than his rug. They broke his tile and...
But the rug, the rug tied the room together.
Tied the whole room together.
That's the worst part. Just that idea of, trying to follow up, with the other guy that you got mistaken for. Like, even that is, an interesting concept of, you should go find the guy that they thought you were and get him to pay you back for it. Even that idea is, ridiculous, to go track down a guy that just happens to have your exact same name and try to get something from him to make up for your property that got destroyed, I do enjoy him getting angry at the dude. What am I supposed to pay for every bum whose rug gets peed on in Los Angeles? I'm just supposed to do that for everybody? Every bum needs a handout. Am I just supposed to do that for everybody?
Philip Seymour Hoffman, how did it go? Oh, it went great. He told me I could have any rug in the house.
he's great as the sidekick to the Big Lebowski, as the kind of the yes man that's always by his side. Like, always telling the dude not to touch things, and then when he meets the Big Lebowski's wife outside, Bunny, and she's just like, I'll suck your dick for $1,000, and he just goes, ha, ha, ho, 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 and he just like doesn't know what to do, just gets that nervous laughter that he doesn't know what to say. She's like, Brant can't watch, or he has to pay $100, and then he's like, oh, I think it's time to go. He just starts getting more and more panicked.
What was the dude's only form of identification?
I think he has that Ralph's card. That membership card. Yeah, is this your only form of identification?
What's the name of the grocery store at the beginning of the movie?
Oh. I remember reading it too, because it says something of Southern California, like it's a chain or something like that. And I can't think of what the name of it is now.
It's called Ralph's.
No, it is just Ralph's that he's in. Yeah, I mean, I should have figured that, since that's what he has the card, and that's what they ask at the end when they need the when they need the receptacle for Donnie's ashes. Like, Walter goes, is there a Ralph's around here?
Yeah. There you go.
Even just that idea of the dude, we get that great opening narration from Sam Elliott, who pops up, momentarily throughout, is great, just referring to everything about the dude. And just the fact that he's in the grocery store writing the check for 69 cents for some half and half because he loves his white Russians. Or Caucasians, as he refers to them. I don't know. Yeah, everything about this movie, it always stands out. Like, there's something, even like the, they have those great, like, throwaway characters. Like, I guess his landlord, the guy that invites him to his one-man stage show.
Yeah.
That shows up.
I love the cop at the pound, where he's just like, you know, I'll get all my men on this.
Yeah, we got the boys working overtime on this case.
Everybody down at the crime lab.
His car itself is like a great running joke throughout the film, and that it keeps getting destroyed slowly over time. Just everything keeps happening to it, and at least half of the things that go wrong with it are related to Walter doing something.
How does it finally die?
When the nihilists set it on fire. That's it.
Not Nazis, they're nihilists. They don't believe in anything.
Yeah. I love how that scares Walter even more when he refers to them as Nazis. And he's like, no, they're not Nazis, they're nihilists. And he's like, oh, say what you will about National Socialism, but that's at least an ethos. The nihilists, they don't believe in anything. The nihilists with Flea and Peter Stormare getting a little bit more of a talkative role. He is great in Fargo, though, is like, he has almost no lines. He doesn't say anything to Steve Buscemi the entire time, which just increasingly aggravates Steve Buscemi throughout that entire movie, that he won't talk to him. He won't have a conversation. He just sits there in silence and just is like yes and no to things. Even when he like gets his the wife like bites his hand, and he just takes off his mask, like slowly walks upstairs to go to the bathroom and get some iodine out of the medicine cabinet while all this insanity's going on around him. He just like is completely unfazed by everything. So yeah.
So where does this put the Big Lebowski? It's film number seven.
Seven. Because. Hudsucker was five, yeah. So Fargo would be six, so yeah.
Do you have a lot of movies to watch between this and the next one?
I think at least... Yeah, there's probably... I was trying to think of which one we're doing next. Yeah, there's got to be at least The Man Who Wasn't There, Oh Brother Where Art Thou, Lady Killers. I mean, I could watch Intolerable Cruelty if I really wanted to punish myself. That's the only one of theirs I don't own, so I'd have to find it on a streaming service if I really wanted to watch it. It's the only one that I never have gotten around to buying because I've never had a reason to want to buy it. So we'll see.
I had it, but I don't have it. I think my mom bought it years ago. That's why I thought I had it.
Yeah.
When I moved out, I didn't take it. I was like, it's yours. Keep it.
We got a few in there. I've The Man Who Wasn't There, I never watched. That's another one that I didn't realize. I think I always forget that that's one of their movies. It's another one that I've owned forever and just never got around to watching. So I'll be interested to watch that. I've seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. That might be my second favorite Coen Brothers film. The Big Lebowski and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
The hard comedies.
That's a double feature that I could watch anytime, all day, every day. Put the Big Lebowski and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou back to back, and I could watch that anytime.
Yeah, I could do that, and then I could do the serious side too. I could do Fargo and No Country for Old Men back to back.
Yeah,
if you like things to be a little darker.
Yeah, if you want things to get a little more gruesome. But yeah, there's all the. All the twists that this film takes just keep getting deeper and deeper. I do especially like some of the like really great edits, like when he gets out of the limo after seeing Maud And he's like joking, having a good time in the back of the limo. He has like the white Russian. He's like, he's talking to the limo driver. He's like, you know, I used to think rich people were, kind of lame, but I could get used to this kind of stuff. And then as soon as he gets out of the limo, he's immediately grabbed by the other limo driver and slammed into the other, the other limo. Yeah. Where he delivers this, hey man, watch, there's a beverage here. And he's thrown into the Big Lebowski's limo with him and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, I like some little things too when he's trying to block up his door with that chair, and then they just open the door the other way,
which just immediately falls out.
Gag that we've seen 100 times before, but it's a lot funnier when he ends up back in his apartment and he trips over the fucking 2x4 that he nailed to the ground.
Yeah, there's moments like that are perfect, like comedic gold. Yeah, the way that's like planted and then paid off later of just him running in and tripping on that thing.
So many, like even when he's getting his head dunked in the toilet and he gets out and he's like just there in this like really shitty bathroom and he's like, do I look like I have money?
Yeah. Do I look like I'm married? The toilet seat's up. Yeah. He gets attacked in his bathroom frequently. He also gets attacked by the amphibious rodent kept by the nihilists.
Yeah. What is that?
A marmot?
Yeah.
Toss that in there. We'll cut off your Johnson, Lebowski.
What kind of car does Walter destroy?
Oh, I can't think of what I always want to say it's a Camaro. I can't remember if that's right, though.
Corvette.
I knew it was like an American sports car. Like I knew it wasn't like a Ferrari or anything like that. Yeah, a little Larry.
What profession is Carl Hungus in the porno log jamming?
He's the cable guy. Although I think he like mispronounced these. Like he's like, I heard your cable's out. Like as his terrible.
What do you think's gonna happen, German Lebowski? Accent.
I don't know. He fixes the cable. Yeah. There's too much in that. They bury all those like little hints and jokes in there. I do love Jackie Treehorn when we finally meet him, which is such a ridiculous moment when he goes in there. And when he takes that phone call and you think he's like writing a phone number down and the dude's
the way that they shoot it, he's all suspicious, like looking over his corner, over the corner of his shoulder, writing it down and taking it with him so he can't see what it was.
I love that moment when he like, that's one of the few times that the dude genuinely has like a really good idea that he's like, I could take a pencil and I could rub it on the top sheet and I'll see exactly what I wrote down. And when it's just that doodle.
That's another plant and payoff though, because when the cops get him and they go into his wallet, they pull out that picture.
Oh, it's such a great moment. I just love that. Like, one of the few times that he actually thinks he has a good idea and it just doesn't do anything for him. It's just he's just completely stuck with nothing to do.
Yeah, this is essentially our wild episode.
It really
Maybe
is.
I'll go back and I'll be like, this is what the Big Lebowski is about.
What is it about? A dude.
It's a dude who is a product of his time. He's in his place. Because this movie is really not a comedy. It's not about the laughs. It's about the early 90s, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a very specific film. They even tell us early in the film, because this was released in 1998, but they tell us that it's from that the story takes place in the early 90s, and that's why they're referring to Desert Storm and everything, and George H.W. Bush is still the president, so it has to be, 1990, 1991 or something like that.
Yep. Absolutely is.
Yeah, I would agree with you that this movie isn't about the comedy in necessarily like specifically writing the jokes. It is almost kind of like the ridiculousness of kind of being, it's almost like these characters are trapped in a film noir and why some of that stuff is ridiculous, like some of the ideas that just come up.
It really follows the basic plot points of any neo-noir that I can think of.
Like, very strictly, but then just kind of, like, subverts every expectation you have for there to be.
Right, like, somebody winds up dead, or there's, like, not things that are... Are there things that are answered, but only to the audience? Such as when they have Bunny's toe. And yeah. Walter's like, yeah, anybody could have done that.
I can get,
like,
you a toe. You want nail polish on it?
Get a toe from? He's like, I'll get you toe by 3 o'clock if you want a toe. And then you end up seeing that woman that's with the nihilist that has her toe cut off. Yeah. Which, when they show her driving the car, when you see that she's alive, and they show both feet, you can't see the pinky toe from, like, the second foot. So it looks like you can't see the nail. So it looks like it possibly could have been.
Yeah, she was never kidnapped. It goes back and forth between she was kidnapped to she kidnapped herself to she wasn't kidnapped at all. She was just partying with a friend.
I like explaining how she kidnapped herself. Well, how could she kidnap herself, dude?
Yeah. Where are we going? What do you mean we? I mean the royal we, like we did it.
We did it together, yeah. Yeah.
Throughout the ringer. The ringer was a ringer. No one ever had the money.
Which is such a noir thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and even just to have, like, again, that, like, MacGuffin of, misdirect with Little Larry, who his might be, like, the one of the hardest things to figure. Well, I guess the only thing we know for sure is that he definitely was, like, joyriding in the dude's car and left his English homework or something in there. But, like, yeah, where everything goes. Yeah, somebody stole my car. Is there anything in it? Tape deck? Creedence Clearwater tapes? Yeah, I wouldn't count on getting those back.
And a briefcase with my work documents in it. Sir, what do you do? I'm an unemployed.
Yeah, well, yeah. And they stole my rug. Your rug was in the car? No, it was a separate thing. The guy gets excited. Separate He's like, incident. Separate incidents. But then, yeah, the voicemail. This is Maude. I stole your rug. And he's like, guess we can close the case on that one. Which, yeah, Maude's, Julianne Moore is great in this movie, too, is that character. And he, like, never knows what to make of her. She seems very much like a feminist, and he, like, doesn't know how to approach anything that she's telling him all the time.
It also seems like, I don't know if it's his view, but anything that's in the art world is, like, way askew, like, to the point that, like, he can't comprehend it.
Yeah.
What's that guy from Naked that's in it?
David Thewlis.
Yeah, and he just giggling.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's the
point.
The fuck are you laughing
at? Yeah. He's constantly, like, referring to everything. And he's like, have a seat, make yourself at home. Do you want a drink? And he goes, yeah. And then he just goes, well, the bar is behind you.
Yeah, after he sits down.
Then they start, like, having their phone conversation where, like, they're both on the phone, him and Maude, and they're just, like, yeah, they're both giggling and talking in French, and he's just like, and the dude's just standing there and can't understand any of it.
Yeah, but between those two and Jackie Treehorn, it's just, and the nihilist, because, you know, the one's a porn star, it's just like he can't comprehend these people in this world.
Yeah.
That are right outside his door, since he lives there. You know, he lives in Los Angeles. How do they say it? They say
Yeah, Los Angeles.
Which is funny, because it's exactly what Chet says in Barton Fink.
Yeah, the way he pronounces it. I mean, that technically it would be probably closer to, like, how it's supposed to be pronounced. Again, like, Americans take everything and really Americanize it to say, like, Los Angeles.
I think we just say LA now. I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, all those little moments are great. Yeah, and I like how she keeps referring to he needs to see a doctor. She's like, he's very thorough, is just how she keeps referring to him. And he's like, no, it's really fine. And she's like, I need you to go see him. He's very thorough.
Well, when he does see him, too, for his head injury, he's like, no, I'll take off your pants. And he's like,
no, she hit me in my face. He's like, just take off your pants. And he's like, okay. So, yeah, he's blasting some Creedence on the way home. Yeah, they like to throw all those little moments. They get into the music a lot in this one, which then leads into like doing "O Brother, Where Art Thou," which gets even more into that old Americana music that this was the first one that they worked with T-Bone Burnett doing he's credited as the music archivist, I think, getting all those old classic tunes to put in.
I technically work with him.
What was he on that you worked on?
Love the Coopers. Good old T-Bone. I think that's exactly what my production accountant said. It was like, T-Bone, he worked with the Coens.
Yeah.
I'd love to work with the Coens.
He worked with the Coens. He worked with Dylan. He was with them when he did the Rolling Thunder.
There you go.
It all connects back. Which then it's like not a shock at all that this film uses that Bob Dylan song multiple times throughout, because he's got that connection.
And they keep doing the Hotel California.
Yeah,
I like the Spanish version that you hear, and then when he's had that last draw with the taxi driver, and he's like playing.
He's had a really rough night. I fucking hate the Eagles, man. Can you just turn it off?
What does Donnie keep repeating when the dude can't remember that Vladimir Lenin?
I am the walrus. You know, he said, "I am the walrus." Yeah, V.I. Lenin. Oh, yeah. Yeah, every time. And I do also enjoy, Walter makes me think of, I start to think of Bryan Cranston from Seinfeld with like the converting to Judaism. And that, like, being the thing that the dude keeps mocking him for, and he's like, "You're not even Jewish, Walter." And he's like, "You know, I converted when I got married." He's like, "And now you're divorced." He's like, "Oh, what am I just supposed to give up being Jewish?"
Yeah, that's interesting too, because he's the one talking about Judaism the most, and you're like, "He's definitely not Jewish." And then you have somebody like John Turturro who's playing like some supposedly Spanish person.
Yeah. Yeah, they do love to just throw. I mean, yeah. That was after John Turturro played a Jewish character in two of their films, and now he's playing a Spanish character in this film. So he just they really do. They really just didn't care. They're just like, you can play whatever you want. You can get into that. Spanish may be closer to Italian, I guess, than Jewish that he played in the other two films. It was at least somewhat closer to his ancestry in this film.
True.
Yeah, he kind of gets he's almost like the Steve Buscemi in this film. Like, Steve Buscemi got all those small but ridiculously memorable parts. In this one, he kind of gets that.
He's got that Barton Fink money.
He does. Yeah, what does he need that money for? He was in Barton Fink that one time. Yeah, they get the really great performances out of all these actors. And obviously, again, they worked with Jeff Bridges later on in... Which almost just feels like his performance in True Grit feels like more of a sequel to The Dude, in that his Rooster Cogburn is very much The Dude, but in an Old West.
He's like the great 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 grandfather of The Dude.
Yeah, yeah. If they were more like Tarantino, it would be somehow revealed that like his family name is Lebowski or something like that. Like he would put in that kind of plot point, like Brunhilde von Schaft.
That's exactly what it would be.
But yeah, that very much is like a very similar character in the way that he plays in True Grit, which I love as well. Yeah, they got a lot of I would say this is like one of their more star-filled casts, although they did start working with George Clooney after this, and you know, they got Tom Hanks eventually. They worked their way up. They were back in the days when they could only hire John Goodman.
I mean,
to play
they started
all the
with
parts.
Academy Award-winning actor Frances McDormand.
True.
I mean, they made already, her basically.
Her credits on the Blood Simple poster already said Academy Award winner Frances McDormand. They're like, it'll be true one day. It'll be a fact one day. They were getting around there. They were working with the whole cast of Boogie Nights throughout these films. They had William H. Macy in Fargo. You get Philip Seymour Hoffman here. Yep. They're getting around. That's
the whole cast, all two of the people I mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah, Julianne Moore was there.
There you go.
He got a few of them there.
He got Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
That's where it ends.
That's where it ends, yeah. Couldn't get anyone else. Can't get any of those other great actors. Don Cheadle was in Lady Killers, wasn't he? Like 99% sure. Or either that or I'm racist. It's one or the other. I'm either 99% sure he was in Lady Killers or, you know. I know I'm not thinking of Damon Wayans. Or Marlon Wayans, sorry. Now I am racist.
Chuck.
Get the fact now.
Oh, man, you're fucking it up, Chuck.
I know. Forgetting all those great actors in the Lady Killers.
I thought you were looking it up for some reason.
I was trying to find it, but then I realized it wasn't worth it.
Well, yeah, you're like, this is taking too long. Yeah. I don't even care.
Don't even care at this point. Already lost it.
Since we are all basically drunk on Coen Brothers and jumping through all Coen Brother films,
yeah,
slightly focusing on The Big Lebowski.
Only slightly.
Only slightly. Like, I saw new information about The Tragedy of Macbeth. And Joel Coen said that this is a movie that he would never have made with Ethan. Because Ethan would have never wanted to make it. And apparently it's something that Frances McDormand wanted him to do for like a long time. As, you know, playing Lady Macbeth. So I'm interested to see.
Yeah. I'll get to watch it if it's...
January 14th, yeah, this week. You can watch this weekend.
When this episode comes out.
There's all kind of stuff this weekend to watch. Well, when this comes out, yeah, the day this comes out, you can watch The Tragedy of Macbeth on Apple Plus. Apple TV Plus, I guess.
I'll probably get into that. Also, another bit of foreshadowing, or perhaps somebody just thought the line was hilarious. That I always think of every time I watch this movie is when they walk outside and you get, dude, where's your car?
Mm-hmm.
And at 100%, it's like the exact same. It's like, and he's like, "Where's your car, dude?" And I'm like, "It's 100% like the exact same line." Like, I just genuinely questioned. I was like, "Was somebody watching The Big Lebowski?" And was just like, "What if that was the whole movie?" That one joke line when they walk outside and Walter says, "Dude, where's your car?"
Unfortunately, that movie still exists in our memories. The "Dude, Where's My Car?" movie.
Unfortunately, that's. That's
your favorite movie.
That's my favorite movie the Coens didn't get to make.
That's a pretty bold statement.
That's another movie that I feel like if I were to rewatch that film and you started hitting me with trivia, I'd remember every single thing from that because I saw that movie so many times when I was a kid. I mean, that came out in 2000, so I would have been 10 when that movie came out.
It's also not a long movie, and they fucking repeat everything.
But that was like one of those movies that I probably thought that was the funniest movie I'd ever seen for a good while after that came out. I always thought, what does my tattoo say? Sweet! What does my tattoo say? Dude!
Have you revisited it? Do you think you still like it?
Oh yeah, I've still rewatched it a few times.
What other movies would fit into that category? Like Bubble Boy?
I didn't even see Bubble Boy when it first came out. I didn't see that till years later, so it never got like, it never got stuck in my mind as being like, oh, that's a hilarious movie. I need to watch that over and over again.
I feel like Dude, Where's My Car? Was like, it's American Pie, but for kids or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It doesn't go all the way. It's not fully R-rated.
Doesn't go all the way.
Yeah, you don't get all that stuff, but. Yeah, that is.
It's American Pie for kids. Yeah.
That is a good description. Yeah, for kids that were too young to get into those theaters, that is a pretty accurate description, I would say. I feel like the only other movies like from
Lebowski kind of ages like that too, because you have, I grew up watching it on television, and then I progressed to, you know, the R-rated. I own it. I get to hear everything version. Not that anything is quite shocking. You know what he's saying.
It's just, yeah. This is what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps.
The worst cut of any movie that I've ever seen. Well, I grew up on the TV version of Pet Sematary.
Yeah.
And then when I finally bought it for like, I don't know, $6, there was like, it was so much gorier and violent than I ever knew. And I'm like, they fucking cut this out of the made for TV version.
There's so many. Yeah. There's so many great ones like that. Like, Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon from Die Hard.
My name's Buck and I'm here to party.
Yeah, that's a good one. And Scarface, where'd you get that scar? Eating pineapple.
Swordfish, when Halle Berry's down on her knees and she's like, do you want me to shine your shoes?
Yeah, there's so many good ones that you just watch that, and at that point you're just like, why'd you even get this movie? Why'd you even want to put this movie on your channel if you were gonna have to like chop this much out of it and make it like incomprehensible sometimes, or just make things like make no sense whatsoever?
Or some are actually really impressive edits, like Pulp Fiction. They edit out the gimp and somehow it doesn't lose any context.
Yeah,
they somehow, I don't know how they did it, they pulled it off.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
I did see recently too that Joel Cohen said that he's not a purist, and that he knows that most of his fans are actually from people that have watched his movies on television. So he knows that they've watched like the edited versions. And
I mean, most of their movies, a few of them get like really gory and violent, or you get some of those moments like, Peter Stormare shoving the body into the wood chipper in something like Fargo.
That... It's also worse when you don't have that much violence throughout. Like, oh, well, you do, but it's like there's this tension that's built up. Yeah. It's not nonstop violence.
I feel like their movies make me think of, and I'm sure this is an influence on theirs, but like Robert Altman, who's like one that I can remember like reading a quote that he said he wanted to make sure, even though his movies, he would try to like throw like F words or something in there just to make them be rated R so that kids wouldn't go see his movies. Cause he said like, they won't understand anyway. Like, what's the point? Like, I don't want kids in my movie theater watching my films. Like, but he had nothing else that he was going to put it. Like, they weren't violent. They didn't have nudity. So it would just be like, the only thing you could get it rated R for is like put curse words into it or something like that.
Some of them are violent. Shortcuts. The kid gets run over by the car.
Yeah. There's moments here and there, but he's not just flat out. The same with like the
it's
Coen
nothing
brothers.
But violent in McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Yeah, there's comedy thrown in that too, though. Again, I would say like McCabe and Miss Miller feels like definitely like an inspiration on the Coens. Like, I feel like they 100% take things from that into their films, especially when they started doing more of their specifically like Western films, like getting into True Grit.
It's amazing how funny they are and how funny they can make things that are situational. And The Big Lebowski is one of those movies that I kind of put on there with Dumb and Dumber, that for some reason it never loses anything. You can watch it in 10 years and it's just as funny. Knowing everything doesn't ruin that movie.
No. This almost gets to the point of like, I feel like this is a movie that I would watch as almost like a Rocky Horror Picture. Like, I know they do like those fan festivals, like they've done like the Lebowski Fest and stuff like that, but this is really a movie that I feel like I could go into a theater and I wouldn't even be mad at like people like screaming the lines at the screen, because they're all just so memorable. Like, people just yelling at the screen like, I'm the walrus or something like that, like just saying those kind of ridiculous things, because it's just that funny. Yeah, like I said, that's what I would almost describe this movie as to me, is like my Rocky Horror Picture. Like, I could watch this movie any day, and yeah, knowing the lines just makes it even funnier. Yeah, I always think of another scene that I could watch a million times is him getting hit in the head with that coffee mug.
Mm-hmm.
Sheriff, I don't like your jerk off face. I don't like your jerk off attitude. I don't like how you jerk off around here. And he's just like, I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. Yeah, I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. He just hits him with that. Oh, you fascist.
I think it's because it seems so violent. It's like,
it hits him so hard.
It's almost more violent than the wood chipper in Fargo. It's just such a, it's the sound. It's sound design that makes it seem so much worse.
Such a loud thud when it hits him in the head.
Well, you know how the Malibu police are.
Yeah.
That's another thing I think that's funny, is how they're supposedly the most threatening force there is, and it's like the like it's a joke in itself, the Malibu police.
Yeah.
Our neighbors on the beach, they don't want your kind here, you know.
Yeah, go back, you bum.
Is he a bum?
I mean, he's just in between jobs. He's just currently
unemployed. I hope you don't dress for that while you... I hope you don't dress like that when you're looking for work. It almost feels like me, as I go from job to job to job, I progressively get worse at interviewing to the point that I felt like one day I'm just going to show up in the bathrobe and the jellies.
Yeah.
And I'll be drinking the white Russian.
Just be like, man, you're either going to hire me or you're not. you know, we're not, I'm not going to pretend that this isn't how I am.
Yeah, do you have anything or you don't have anything? Yeah, or
just
what?
Tell me and I'll go somewhere else, I guess.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing to probably, the hardest reason it is to discuss this film is because there's like a million different things that stand out that are hilarious. And I think that's probably the hardest thing to talk about. How do you talk about something that's funny and what makes everything so funny?
Yeah.
The delivery is great from almost every single character, which probably falls back 100% on the direction. I don't know if all the serious actors could have pulled off the... Like, I'm trying to think of one where they just fail. Because, like, Steve Buscemi's pretty funny in, like, everything. He pops up in an Adam Sandler movie. He's still funny, and it's the Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah. Yeah,
and Jeff Bridges is, like, you don't get the comedies. He's one of those actors that keeps going back and forth between very serious stuff. Didn't he do like Crazy Heart and
Yeah,
it's that I don't know. They have that skill. Then you get interesting things like Buster Scruggs where they do the comedy and the serious. They'll mix them up.
Yeah, that feels like every movie is just like there's just a percentage. Like you're going to get the comedy and the serious drama, and it's really just a matter of where that line falls. Like, is it going to be 90% comedy and only 10% of drama and intrigue, or is it going to go something like Fargo, that's going to go a lot more like 90% of it's a very serious and dark film, but every once in a while you get like Steve Buscemi doing.
Is this a real movie?
Yeah, we don't know where that falls on the scale. There is not a scale that can measure that film.
At least we both agree that's the worst.
Yeah, we can all agree that is
the worst one. Can we decide on the best?
That's always going to be a tough one. It that feels like then you really have to sit there and I could see a lot of people wanting to say, well, my favorite comedy of theirs is The Big Lebowski. But yeah, if someone else would say, but if I was picking like a serious movie, then I'd say No Country for Old Men. But I still have to say, like, hands down, the one that I could watch more often than any other one, and I have watched it more often, is always going to be The Big Lebowski. There's nothing bad about that movie. It's almost perfect.
And I think that's the hardest thing to figure out. What makes it so perfect?
It's just everything.
What makes it so rewatchable?
I don't know. Like you said,
it's like a 2-hour comedy.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare. It has about 5 plots going on.
It is just, I think it is that get them, all the performances are great, and they kind of know where to use their actors that they can get a lot out of. Like, even Tara Reid's in it, and I would never say like Tara Reid's a great actress, but they know to like only use her. She's only in it sparingly. Is kind of the
about that too. Like, she's decent in this movie.
Yeah.
And what's the only other movie? Probably American Pie. And then after that, like anything you
it's
see
like her next
in,
bigger thing. Yeah. Yeah, now she's in, she's been in, Sharknado movies and stuff like that. She's not doing anything too big at this point, but I think it's just, like, they know their strengths, they probably know, they might not have really said this to her or something, but I'm sure they, like, looked at it and were like, yeah, she's not a great actress, but we can put her in the scene for 5 minutes and it'll be fine. She's funny in that one moment, and then we can just use her sparingly throughout. And they just know, like, when to...
Or even, I don't even think she's the funniest. It's just that she's the right character for the role.
Yeah.
Her persona is not so far off from what they want the character to be.
No. Even get other, like, even just other, like, background guys, like Flea and the other, the other nihilist, who's just there, just as kind of like a, to be a background character. And
I swear
really
to God, Flea
else.
Shows up in everything.
When you least expect it, there's Flea.
He's there, yeah. It's just like a weird short role, but he's always there.
It feels like he just comes with Los Angeles. Like, if you're going to film a film in L.A., it's like, don't forget you got to have Flea.
He just shows up on set. You're like, he's a character in your movie.
Yeah, he's here, man. You can't do anything about it. He's got to be in your film. You're in Los Angeles. That's where he lives. Yeah, there's just so much that works. Like, and I even enjoy, like, Sam Elliott, just as the narrator, is just fun to just randomly be there. He gives that opening narration and then meets the dude halfway through and, you know, gives him that, sometimes you eat the bar and sometimes the bar eats you, which is like his favorite, the dude's favorite catchphrase, which he tries to use at the end.
I think that's pretty cool, Dawn, with him having a role into the story somewhat, being the narrator, but then the narrator, like, it gets involved somewhat.
Yeah, he steps into the story to have that conversation.
Yeah, they took that little bit and they put it in the Fargo show, too. The four seasons of Fargo, if there may be more, but that show started off as Fargo, but it's just basically nonstop Coen Brother references.
Yeah.
It references, like, so many different movies, but it just keeps the Fargo name. And characters, I guess, too.
Yeah, a little bit.
Billy Bob Thornton.
David Thewlis.
David Thewlis from this. He's the big bad in season 3. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the hardest thing about trying to talk about this. It's such an enjoyable movie. And we could do part 2, and you just break it down with all the answers as to how this movie got made.
Yeah, we could always, we can throw things like that out there. Yeah, it really is. Yeah, I don't know. It is hard to describe, and like, I can't put my finger on what it is exactly that I love about this movie so much. It is, like I said, this movie is, in my mind, basically perfect. Like, there's not a single thing in this film that I could think that, like, well, you know what? I would have changed this, or I'd have maybe, like, edited this out or not even put this in. Like, even just the smallest things, like it all just works in there, and it just fits and just keeps adding things to the story that don't even necessarily need to be there, but they're still just funny. Like, when they go to Larry's house and it's the guy's in the giant iron lung, and Walter's just like, does he still write? And then the lady's like, no, he doesn't write. He's in an iron lung. Like, there's no other thing to say to it. Just other than, like, no, he doesn't write anymore.
The police are here to see you, Larry. Oh, I don't want to get off the impression that we're the police.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, everything, even about just like, I could watch an entire movie that's just Walter and Donnie, like, it being together, because they're just so opposite from each other. They constantly go back and forth, but then every once in a while he'll just stop and he's like, when he just wanders over and he's like, hey, they posted the league schedule, and he just starts screaming at him, and then he goes, what are we playing?
See, that's the thing. I think when you watch Jesus Rules, you'll realize that the Walter and Donnie movie don't work.
If it was too much.
The Big Lebowski is the perfect science of just the right amount of time with all these characters. And if you have too much or you don't have enough, it doesn't work. That's my two cents.
Yeah. It could be. Could be that they're, you know, you might get that every once in a while. Is that train doing?
I thought I heard like a
Yeah, it like it, I turned the mic off while it was like really blasting, and then I was like, it kind of stopped, and I was like, oh, I think I can turn the mic back on. And yeah, that like whoever's driving the train is like just going like, and I'm like, what are they doing? But yeah, yeah, I guess that could be the case that you could have yeah, you might mess up the formula, and that I guess might have been what happened there with Jesus Rolls, and that it is again kind of like I said, like the Coens just know that perfect amount. That too much or too little would throw something off, and they know where to start and where to stop. That's their real gift. They know. I think it also helps them being like, I think one of the most overlooked things maybe about them is that they edit their own films. Everyone knows they obviously write and direct all their films, but there is something about, I feel like, I don't know, maybe like just the general, like average viewer, that might be like not a position that a lot of people think about, but I think there is something to say about something like even Scorsese, like working with Thelma Schoonmaker for just years and her editing every single one of his films for such a long time, that you really like, it's just an extension. Like she already knows how he's probably going to want to edit these shots. Like he might come in and want to like, you know, yeah, tweak things here and there, but just even
hey,
the idea.
She's the one that said too, where she was asked why she makes such violent movies, and she's like, well, they're not violent until I start putting them together.
Yeah. But yeah, there is something about that. And I think just that idea that, you know, that's especially where a lot of directors can run into having that final cut option. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You get a lot of those directors that, like, I think we've mentioned it probably multiple times here when we've talked about movies being edited, but you know, someone like Judd Apatow being one that if you just let him like do what he wants to do, he's just going to have like a 4-hour long movie, and he's not going to cut any of those scenes down. Cause he's just like, oh, every joke they said was funny. I have to leave the whole scene, and it's going to run too long. And he does that.
It's like, they are all funny, but people are going to get tired.
Yeah. People are going to get bored with that. So I think there is something very unique about the fact that they've edited all of their films for their whole career. Occasionally they've had, you know, co-editors that assist with them, but
I feel like a lot of times they do, but they're always involved.
They're always like the main editor, or they definitely have a final say on what's going to happen with it. There's definitely no one else sitting there that's going to come in and tell them, I don't know, I think maybe you should work on this, or maybe you should do this. Like, I think they're always, they kind of go into it, and it probably also helps even when they're shooting that they can kind of visualize it in their head already as they're on the set. Like, okay, when we get to the editing, we're going to want to cut it like this. So just don't even bother filming anything that we don't really need, or we kind of just know this is how we're going to get, which John Goodman's kind of said too. And I think he said he told, I want to say it was either, I think it was Jeff Bridges when they started working on this, that he kind of mentioned, Jeff Bridges mentioned something about like, oh, I hope, like, I don't know, these guys are going to want to like improvise, or am I going to get like rewrites every day? And like John Goodman told him like, no, once the Coens like write their script, like they don't rewrite it. Like once you get it, that's it. You're not going to get rewrites every day telling you like, oh, we decided to change a scene. He's like, they pretty much know what the movie's going to be before they even started filming it. Like it's already been, they've already seen the whole thing in their mind as to what it's going to look like when they wrote it down, and they're not going to change it. They have in their mind what they're going to do with it.
I mean, I think the idea over time is that you can't work with multiple directors. Multiple directors, just, you know, too many cooks idea. Yeah. And the Coen brothers, I believe they're one of the few that have mastered the idea of collaboration. And I think that's why their movies turn out so perfectly, because there's trust in the editing, I'm sure, when it's not even just them and they're working with someone else, that, you know, that's, they're trusting their opinion. And I think they're taking a lot of trust in, you know, the music and the cast and everything else. And they seem like the people that would take, you know, advice or have some open ears to see what could possibly make their movie better. And The thing that I noticed too is from them editing, the style, like their style that's there, and then there's a part of them that they're always seem to be trying to do something completely new. So you can compare something like Fargo to No Country for Old Men, but No Country for Old Men seems like such a darker movie. They play around with the plot in ways that you don't see in most movies. And I kind of feel like that's the biggest appeal to them, is that they have that signature, but at the same time, some of these movies you could watch, and people would be like, I didn't even realize that that was the same person. You know, could you imagine that the person that did The Big Lebowski, well, you gotta assume this is people that don't know filmmakers very well, the same people. The same person that did The Big Lebowski did No Country for Old Men. I don't think you get any different than that.
Yeah. Which, I mean, again, we talked about it. That is what they enjoy doing. Because I feel like that's exactly what people probably thought when if they first saw Blood Simple and watched that film, and then you went to see Raising Arizona, would you at all think that that was made by the same, like, if you watch those two, since I've been watching all those movies in order, like, just watching those two back-to-back is one of the biggest, like, they really do go from...
It'd be great if Raising Arizona was just a poster, and it was, like, from the people that brought you Blood Simple.
Yeah.
And you didn't know anything more than that.
Yeah, but, like...
I know that Max Bemis from Say Anything, he's the baby on the poster. He's not the baby in the movie.
In the film, but he's just on the poster.
He's the one on the poster. Or he's lying to us, and he's like, hey, that's a baby, and that's a story I'm going to stick with.
He might go with something like that. But yeah, I know that's why they've... Because I was also, like, I've read some of the other stories that they've talked about, where, again, that they... Like kind of how you said, like, I think they are open to collaboration to a certain point, but I do know they... I guess they kind of do draw a line at somewhere that they do have... just their idea in their mind, and they do start to get kind of annoyed when others start to try to be like creative and helpful and like add things in. Cause I know that's one of the things that they said about working with Nicolas Cage. Like, I guess they didn't get along with him because he was like, you know, again, he like tries to get like too into it. Maybe sometimes like he wanted to do all sorts of like weird things with his character, and was like, maybe my character does this kind of thing. And the Coens are like, no, he doesn't. Like, we already wrote the script. Like, we know what your character does. Like, you just, like, kind of, we'll give you direction, but...
When you plan something that well, and you're confident in what you're doing, if somebody ad-lib stuff, like, I mean, you're asking for maybe a huge plot hole in there.
Yeah.
Especially if they take all the takes that you meant to do.
Yeah.
It's strange. Filmmaking is such a strange... interesting thing, because you never can, I mean, you can follow your plans 100% through and make a terrible movie. So I feel with the Coens that it's kind of like 90% that, if they're not changing any of the lines, so they're sticking with the format, but maybe they end up having, like you said, the blueprint is the screenplay. And they put in everything in there that they can play around with in the editing room.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that is where they... I think that's why they enjoy especially working with some of these more... The character actors, like getting with people like John Goodman, Steve Buscemi, and John Turturro, who they've worked with so many times, is they know those guys will just... like, not just blindly, you know... go out and just do exactly what the script says. Like, you know, they'll bring a little bit of personality to it, but they know that they don't have like an ego of like, oh no, I have to make myself funnier, or I have to like, yeah, like add some, or you're not gonna like, you know, Steve Buscemi's not gonna go up to the Coens and be like, hey, can you like punch up my dialogue and make it funnier? Like, I don't think I'm funny enough in these scenes. Like, they know they'll just come in and like deliver the lines like as best as they can. And I think it's even something that worked for them. And even Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, I think, is a good example of George Clooney kind of just like falls into that Coen brothers rhythm of, it doesn't feel like he's ever trying to just be like you know, typical movie star. I feel like
we're
going
to do Coen's part too.
We 100% have to, because there's enough films that we're not even getting to that we need to talk about. But yeah, someone like George Clooney, I feel like, fits into that role perfectly in a film like that of just gets in there, doesn't try to do too much. Or Matt Damon in True Grit, I think it's another one where he just kind of gets into that character and doesn't feel like he's trying to like steal the show away from Jeff Bridges
trust.
Or Hayley Steinfeld. 100%
trust you. They go in and they know that. I mean, think about a lot of these people. George Clooney, Matt Damon, they're making a shit ton of movies where they're always the lead. And I think they get to a point where, like, have I been in a Coen Brothers movie? Even like Brad Pitt, because he ends up in Burn After Reading.
Yeah.
So,
with George Clooney. Yeah. When George he stole Clooney the whole cast from Ocean's 11, he stole the main cast from Ocean's 11 for their films.
Yeah, I think that these actors, Matt Damon is particularly. He pops up in everything for like these bit roles, and I think he just enjoys making fun of himself or being something that's laughed at almost.
Yeah, I mean, I still think one of his, and again, I think it's another director that we'll have to do at some point is Soderbergh, because The Informant is one of my favorite movies from him and one of my favorite Matt Damon films, because again, it's just such a ridiculous character that Matt Damon just gets into that's so laughable. So that almost feels like that could exist in the same universe as The Big Lebowski, like his character from that film, that a goofy guy that's in over his head and kind of like thinks he's in some sort of like noir plot. Like he thinks he's just like your average guy that's working for the CIA.
That movie, I don't know what it says, reminds me of my father. He looks like my father when I was like growing up in like the early 90s, like that mustache, and it's eerie. It's just so eerie. But I don't know. It's the faith that they take where he knows that let's have this character who's awful person and a bad liar. And the bad liar is what makes it funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll have to, maybe we'll get into that. Not in the first four directors that were doing this.
Yeah, we've
this year. We do directors for the rest of the show forever.
Forever.
Forever and ever.
Till we run out of directors.
I don't think we can.
Yeah. Do we start getting into like the really obscure directors that no one's ever heard of?
I think we're going to have to. Maybe that's what we'll do. After we do these two, we'll pick obscure directors. I mean, they have to have at least have four movies, though.
Yeah, that we can cover.
You're so obscure, or like they're so obscure they only have one movie. But then that gets out of directors, and that just ends up being its own theme.
Yeah.
What restaurant does Larry Sellers live close to?
In-N-Out.
Good.
He lives near the In-N-Out. They have to make that clear multiple times. You said he lived next to the In-N-Out. I said he lives near the In-N-Out.
At the end of the movie, once the dude has figured out what has happened, the Big Lebowski is shown stuffing what into the briefcase to weigh it down?
Phone books.
Excellent. I just felt like I'm going to play this as we get out of the movie.
Yeah.
As we end the show.
Yeah.
Some of these questions are really funny. Here's one that you would never get. Which of the following movies was also directed by the Coen brothers? Your options. Yeah. Jackie Brown, Three Kings, Wag the Dog, Raising Arizona.
Oh, wow. Could it be Raising Arizona? That was such a weird, that was such a weird lineup of films to throw out there.
Yeah, that's one I could have got too. All right, last one.
Yeah.
In the opening scene, the dude wrote a check for the amount of 69 cents. What item did he purchase with?
Half and half.
Brilliant.
That he was already drinking. I love he's still in his mustache as he's paying for the check.
What ties the room together?
That rug.
What's the dude's real name?
Jeffrey Lebowski.
quoting George W. or sorry, H.W. Bush. I got that right.
Yeah.
The dude defiantly stated that this aggression will not
stand.
Perfect. And that's our show. You agree? Yeah, that's
it.
So,
I think that's it.
That's the show. You can follow us on Twitter at Cinema de More, on Facebook / Cinema de More, on Twitter I'm at JJMorgan18. Chuck.
ChuckFan66.
And we'll see you next week with No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
Por el camino del desierto, el viento me despeina, suelo aroma de colita. Ella de lo lejos, una luz centella, la idea de Mezcal. Te vi por en la noche, ella estaba a la entrada y la campana ya sonar. Y me dijo ya mi mimo, esto puedo del cielo. Ella enciende una vela y nuestra de camino. Soy moza el corredor y yo te dije diciendo, he venido del California, such a lovely place,
such a lovely place,
such a lovely place. Bienvenido del California, such a lovely place,
such a lovely place,
such a lovely place. Guapo, llama a mi amigo cuando va en el patio, perfuma de verano, hay que verla para recordar y otra para olvidar. Le pide el capitán que sirva el vino y me dijo no amor, tenido este alcohol. Desde sentí de nueve la voz que llamando desde yo a despertar. La noche para decir, bienvenido del California, such a lovely place,
such a lovely place,
such a lovely place. Bienvenido del California, such a lovely place,
such a lovely place,
such a lovely place.
El espejo en el techo, champaña en el hielo, y ella dijo, somos todos prisioneros. Y a los cuatro principales hace sus siestas, ataca a la bestia con sus puñales, pero no lo logra matar.
Mi último recuerdo, corearse de la puerta, debía encontrar el camino por donde había llegado. El acérrico portero, con eso no recibir. Puede salir cuando quiere, pero nunca de partir. Bienvenido del California, such a lovely place,
such a lovely place,
such a lovely place. Bienvenido del California, such a lovely place,
such a lovely place,
such a lovely place.
to have you here.
Thank you.
And you'll notice, well, you'll notice, but the audience will notice, I introduced you as Buscemi.
Why'd you do that?
Well, I'll tell you why I did that. Because in my extensive research, I learned that that's how you pronounce your last name.
That's true.
Even though everyone else in the entire world pronounces it Buscemi.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, I mean,
what do you want it to be?
Well, I can't say Buscemi because I didn't grow up that way.
Right. Have you just given up on correcting people, or have you...
Well, I don't correct people if they say Buscemi because it's not wrong.
Yeah.
So who am I to say that you're wrong?
Because in fact, in Italy, in Sicily, where your family's from,
Buscemi.
Buscemi. So we're all getting it wrong.
Yeah.
Buscemi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Steve Buscemi.
Buscemi, yeah.
I'll still work on that.
Yes, please.
Should be a pushover.
We'll be near the In-N-Out Burger.
Shut the fuck up,
Donnie.